chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make heaven in the middle of it. Grass make heaven in the middle. We are grass make heaven.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We're going to go back to July of 2009 with this broadcast tonight, and it's going to be both hours. It was just too important. I was going through some of my archives, and I happened to come across some Liberty speakers at one of the Ron Paul functions back in 2009 in the Galveston Civic Center. The lineup that day was started off with Lou Rockwell, who had been a long associate with Ron Paul. And if you go up on the web to lourockwell.com, you'll see many of the fine writings and the people that follow Lou Rockwell and some of his fine writings himself. That first speaker is Lou Rockwell, followed by Tom Woods. A Meltdown was one of the books that he was promoting at the time. And then the third speaker is a fine gentleman, Judge Andrew Napolitano. And those three at that July birthday party for Ron Paul and in the Galveston Civic Center really stuck out in my mind. And so pay careful attention to what these gentlemen are saying. They are probably three of the finest speakers that were out there on the campaign trail with Ron Paul. There's little stories I have about Tom Woods. We were up in Des Moines, Iowa one time, and lo and behold, Ron Paul came flying into Des Moines, Iowa late, and Tom Woods got up there and filled in for 30 or 40 minutes, for Ron Paul, and he's really a fine person. Another story I had was when we were all up at Valley Forge on a Ron Paul campaign for liberty and on the trail, on the campaign trail and so forth, was I went up there about single-handed. I mean, I was more of a pack animal on that trip than about anything. I did have a dolly that I got in the hotel, and I could just cart all of my equipment around. But that was single-handed, and it's me and it's my finest hour, or the worst hour, I guess. But anyway, Judge Napolitano was speaking that day, and that was the only speaker that I couldn't videotape and record. I guess it had something to do with the Fox Network or something. And some of these exclusives like that, they just won't let you record some of those main events, speakers like that. But anyway, instead of recording his video and so forth, I got to sit in the audience and listen to a speech that was similar to this one that we're going to rebroadcast tonight during the last hour. Actually, he's the last speaker. The way I have it set up is the first hour here, you're going to hear Lou Rockwell. And then the last second hour, we're going to start off with Tom Woods, and it's divided pretty equally between Tom Woods and then Judge Napolitano. I happened to be sitting in a place there in the auditorium back at Valley Forge when Napolitano was speaking. I forget the exact year, but what really was poignant and really stood out in my mind that a very, very vivid memory was that there was a little Italian family. From the granddaddy to the children to the grandkids. They were sitting in front of me, and there was about 8 or 10 of them, and they all had Ron Paul books about liberty, freedom, and so forth. And they were talking, and they were really excited. And then they got really excited because Napolitano, being of Italian extraction also, really excited them because they could come to America, you know, and make it here and be prosperous here and be free here and experience liberty here. And that's what that little Italian family said to me. In Austin, my father first began to write wills for an Italian family here in Austin. And much later, decades later, I would become very close friends with these people. And we would do real estate together in the Austin area. So I experienced a little bit of that myself, is that in America, if you go out and work hard, you can make it in this country. And that's what these Italians in Austin, Texas, the friends of mine, did. Their father, their grandfathers, they were shopkeepers, they were storekeepers and grocerymen and so forth. And they ran these small businesses, and some went into insurance and in real estate later. One of my best friends made it to the Austin Board of Realtors as president, the president of the Texas Association of Realtors, and went on to a national directorship at the National Association of Realtors. So that's what America used to stand for. Now, under this Obama regime and even the George W. Bush regime, of which they gave us 9/11, so we can't forget that under George W. But, I mean, it used to be in this country where there was opportunity, and it was wedded together with freedom and liberty. And those things together meant something. And to the people that really begin to awaken to those dynamics, they made it, and they did real well, see. So when I was sitting there in Valley Forge and I was listening to Judge Napolitano, these kinds of emotions ran through my head, see. We have experienced a tremendous debasement of this country over several decades. And I've been speaking about it, and Charlotte's been speaking about it. I will say something about Charlotte. Charlotte Rossi Littlefield Brown. I'm going to say all of her names here tonight. But she is one of the finest gals, one of the finest ladies that I've ever been associated with. She stands on principles, and she won't budge, and she speaks out, and she's really, really a respectful person. So I want to thank Charlotte Littlefield. Excuse me. Let me go back with the full name. Charlotte Rossi Littlefield Brown. And we gave her that Littlefield name. That's part of my family name here in Austin. And we were getting ready to go on the air, and she said, well, maybe my radio name should be a little different, you know, because I think she was involved in the Army still. And I said, well, that might be a good idea. So she started using the name Charlotte Littlefield on the air, even though at times we called her Charlotte Brown, too, you know. But anyway, she's been through a lot, Charlotte has. She's raised two fine girls, daughters, and she's really a stand-up lady. The other things that we've got to look out for in the future is that we've got all of this Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement and these trade initiatives and giving Obama fast-track trade authority, which we should not give him at all. We take an imperial presidency and give them more power. I'm sorry about that. That's the worst thing, possible thing that Congress could do. What surprised me about this Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement and this fast-track trade authority, boy, it really went through the Senate fast, didn't it? And the Republicans were right there supporting it. They should have never supported it. The politics has changed. It's been a sea change that I've noticed, and they're beginning to be more, it's more transparent that both Congress, the representatives, and the senators are bought and paid for. I'm sorry. There's no one representing what Ron Paul was representing when he was running for, you know, the presidential, bid. His first bid was, 2007 up to 8. And then we picked him up, Charlotte and I picked him up, and we continued to go and support him in different places throughout the country. in 2008, we were in Des Moines, Iowa there, and we spent the first day we were down at that tourist spot down there, and where all the music is. We were at that Branson, Missouri. Yeah, Charlie and I were down at that music spot, and we're down there, and we got together with a local Ron Paul. That was on January the 1st, 2008. And we got together, and she had her own program, and I produced it and brought in some original music from a up-and-coming new release out of Nashville, the same guy that did some music up at the Independence Mall in 2007, of November, earlier the previous year. So anyway, we had quite a program there. And it was very exciting. And that was the deadest, Branson, Missouri on January 1 is the deadest day of the year in Branson. So I don't recommend because it's the day after New Year's Eve. Now, New Year's Eve, all of those clubs and show places were full. But the next day, you know, by morning or by the time we checked in later on that afternoon, it was totally, vacant. Oh, no, hotel we stayed in. So I'll never forget, we went up there to check in. We had a dog with us, little William. Charlotte got a little Chihuahua dog, and it wasn't one of these overly nervous ones. It was pretty good. William's a pretty good little dog. Anyway, she got those for the girls, and the girls were pretty young then. And so went to the front desk, and he said, "Y'all have a dog?" And I said, "Yeah, I thought we talked about that, whoever booked it in." He said, "No, we don't allow dogs." And I said, "My gosh, we just got a dog and we need a place to stay." And he said, "Okay." He said, "Bring the dog in the back door." And he said, "We'll look the other way." So that was a pretty understanding, motel general manager, I will say. So we went there on January 1st and did that. And, we did that evening. We did a program with a local Ron Paul meetup group. And then the next day we were in Des Moines, Iowa for a big speech there in the hotel there in downtown Des Moines. And then the next day we did two events. We did an afternoon at the School of Osteopathy there on western part of Des Moines. And then that night we came back in and suffered through a loss there with Ron Paul. And I'll never forget, we went back to our motel, and we were walking past some of these rooms where these college students had been brought in to support Obama. I looked in those rooms, and they were all trashed out, you know. So I thought to myself, "Oh my gosh, is this gonna bode well for the future, administration here, or what? See, what's gonna happen?" But anyway, that was just something that sort of piqued my interest, you know, back then. But anyway, we suffered through the loss with Ron Paul. And Ron Paul is a very gracious person, and he wasn't bitter about it. And that's when I came up with Ron Paul Guardians. Came up with an idea, Charlotte and I did, and we broached it with Ron Paul. And it was about protecting him at these big rallies. But in fact, I went so far as to get internet domain and so forth, and I even cleared it with Jesse Benton and his campaign director, and some of the other people that were involved. I don't think Jesse Benton was the campaign director at that point, but he might have been, the promotions man, I believe. But anyway, we did clear it with some of the top people there in Des Moines, Iowa, before we left about this Ron Paul Guardians, you know. And I thought it was a good idea because this was to put people in the crowd that were Ron Paul supporters and just watch out for any person that might be, a threat to Dr. Paul. But what we've got coming up are these rebroadcasts, starting off, like I said, with Lou Rockwell, this first hour. And then on the second hour, Tom Woods kicks it off. And then who closes it down is Judge Andrew Napolitano. Now, later on this month, we've got some very, very exciting things going on. And it's more organizing those central governments so that they can do more bad things to us, I'm afraid. On June 7th through the 8th, at Schloss Ilmau, that's in Bavaria, Angela Merkel is organizing the G7 over there. And they're going to meet just a few days before the Bilderberg takes place. The Bilderberg meeting this year is the 11th through the 14th. It's June 11th through the 14th. It'll be Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday later on this month. But just 3 days before that, on the 3 to 4 days, June 7th through the 8th, you're going to have the G7 meet. Okay? And I started looking at where they're meeting on the map. And Schloss Ilmau is in Germany, Bavaria, southern Bavaria. It's in the Garmisch-Partenkirchen area, which is not far from Zugspitze, the tallest mountain in Germany. And it's like a conference hall. It's a big building where they hold conferences. There's a big hall in there that they're going to be meeting in. But this is only about 42-minute drive by car to a further to the Interalpen, which is a little bit further to the south. What we have is we have an area there where these people that are coming into the G7 conference can easily make their way down later to the Bilderberg. And we're going to have elements probably from the G7 that will show up on the Bilderberg meeting there. Now, the Bilderberg group is the most powerful group in the world, and they meet annually. We went over, Farrell Montgomery and I held a symposium in Copenhagen last year during the Bilderberg meeting there at the Marriott in downtown Copenhagen. And we were on the outskirts, and we had a real nice venue there. So we had 2 days of a symposium. But this year it's going to be in Austria, close to Innsbruck. Okay, now Innsbruck is about 85 miles south of Munich, but south of there on the side of Austrian side. Now, about northwest of there, about 9 to 10 miles, is this hotel called the Interalpen Hotel, Tyrol. That's Tyrol area of Austria, which is far western part of Austria, close to the Alps, the Austrian Alps. The German Alps are to the north, and further to the west would be the French Alps and so forth. The Italian Alps are coming in there, too. So this is a ski area. And I think the Interalpen, I think, is a ski lodge itself in normal operations. But they are holding the Bilderberg Conference between June 11th and the 14th. The experience that we've had and the knowledge that we had of past Bilderberg meetings is they'll come in late Wednesday evening and early Thursday. They'll usually have a session on Thursday night. They'll meet all day Friday and Saturday. Even into the evenings of Saturday and Friday sometimes. They'll break up into different groups. And by late Saturday, they're finished. And then they'll move out and start leaving the conference there by about Sunday morning. And by Sunday afternoon, by 3:34, they're all gone. Now, there's quite a few topics of discussion this year. It looks like Brzezinski is going to hit the nail on the head. They struck the Ukrainian temporary ceasefire has played into the hands of the Ukrainians in the sense that they have built up their arms with our help, and we've been helping them train their new troops that they've been drafting. So they're building up quite a force to go against the southeastern part of the Ukraine, of which there are Russian troops in there helping. So it hasn't built up yet to a point of outright battle, but we're headed there. So the Bilderberg group, this will be on their schedule, on their agenda for sure. Other things on their agenda will be the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, moving our society into a cashless type of society where they'll have more maximum control. We're talking about the ultimate money people here. There's Mark Carney, and he was there in Copenhagen last year, and he'll definitely be at the Bilderberg meeting there this year. There had been very, very sketchy information. Oh, let me tell you who, before I go on here, with who Mark Carney is. Mark Carney is head of the Bank of England. But also, he's the chairman of the Financial Stability Board that's nested inside of Bank of International Settlements. Now, this Bank of International Settlements was formed in about 1929, and it was to establish a means by which to the reparations that were being paid by Germany after World War I, it was to distribute those and to collect those. So they've been a collection. Then they morphed themselves into much more of a clearinghouse for the central banks of the world, and that's basically their function today. Now, during World War II, they funneled a lot of Nazi gold and money out through the Bank of International Settlements to Argentina and these other countries, of which were friendly to the Nazis. And so we have Alan Dulles over there with the OSS. At that time, and his brother was beginning to take on a national prominence, who he would eventually become Secretary of State under Eisenhower. And with Alan Dulles in there is the director of the CIA, and those two brothers alone, according to Stephen Kinzer, established the Cold War, and this gave a tremendous boost to the arms and defense industries in this country. So, these are some of the dynamics behind some of these. It's all big money. We're talking about international financiers and international institutions. Now, they've got problems with Greece right now, and Greece is having trouble coming up with money to pay some of the obligations on pension funds and things like that within the country. So it remains to be seen what will happen in Greece. They put out feelers now to Putin to try to get some money borrowed from Putin to try to get, you know, back into stabilize their economy and their finances. But it remains to be seen what would happen then. That will be discussed for sure. The European Union is breaking up. Bob Chapman predicted it. We're seeing some weak sisters like Greece and other countries. They're not going to make it, see. And they're not going to have the discipline like Germany has to continue, you could say, to have production. The Germans are very productive, and that's where they have excelled in dominating the European Union. And they will continue, and that's why the European Union, for them, is a means by which to establish their dominance, of which they could not follow through because of their defeat in World War II. There were meetings held with the Nazis towards the end of the war, of the top industrialists and the top Nazis in the regime to take the battlefield to the business arena. And that's exactly what the Germans have done. They flooded a lot of Nazis in to Latin America, and as a consequence, they flooded a lot of Nazis into this country. So there's a different kind of mentality here post-World War II that existed versus pre-World War II. We had a much better country, and I experienced some of it in the 50s. And then because of all of this change, this sea change in Nazis coming in and all this, we've had a tremendous change in attitude of our top elite leadership. And we've got a sort of a psychopathic, dynamic has also developed. And so it hasn't been good for the country. The average American, I've been out talking to more and more of the average American out there, and I'm beginning to understand that, my gosh, these Americans out here, except for the people that have been very, very active with Ron Paul and other very, very good, insightful politicians, they don't get it. I'm sorry, they don't get 9/11. If you don't get 9/11, you're not going to help free this country and keep this country free, because 9/11 is a enslaving mechanism for mind slavery, much less the whole country. So if you can't get 9/11, then you know, we're going to lose the country. We're quickly doing it now. So go and investigate 9/11. Go in there and try to get down to the heart of the matter. Judy Wood has a solution on 9/11, and people are ignoring her. Go in there, Where Did the Towers Go is her book. Go in there and buy that book. And go in, it's $50-something. Go in and split it with someone. But go in to Amazon and order that book from Judy Wood. She's a fine person. I heard her speak a few months ago at Blinn College. There was a speech there, by some local supporters. Well, look, we're getting ready to go into this first speaker, which would be Lou Rockwell, and we're just going to go solid on straight through tonight. We're not going to have any introduction music or anything for the second hour, but the second hour will be Tom Woods, followed by Judge Napolitano. And we want to thank each and every one of you out there. We're working hard. We're working on a new movie. Go in there. I've got a new book out on Amazon called Be Good to Yourself. Buy my book. Get some perks in there on GoFundMe. We need some promotion money to get on these radio programs. But anyway, go in there and I will have click-offs on all of this over the weekend. But thank you very much for listening to our audience. And again, I want to thank Charlotte Rossi, Littlefield Brown, for her hard work and dedication. Thank you, Char.
Are you folks about ready to get started? All right. It is so great to see so many wonderful friends of Liberty, Patriots, Americans, Constitutionalists here today with us in Galveston and Ron's home district. And it just means the world to him that people have gathered from his district and from around the state, and even some friends have made journeys from other states to come visit us. And it's just so wonderful to have you all here. Dr. Paul talks about the importance of political action, but even more important than political action, he talks about the need for education. And if we're really going to save our country, restore our Constitution, and protect our liberties, we need to make a commitment to educating both ourselves, to always be bettering ourselves, and always be increasing our understanding, and also having the tools to be able to talk to our neighbors and educate our neighbors, convince our society that liberty really does work and freedom is the way to go. And we are really blessed and honored to have three very special guests here today that have been leading the country, leading our movement, leading in so many ways over the years. And we all owe them a real great debt, and it's just going to be great to hear them speak today. Our first guest is the founder of the Ludwig von Mises Institute, was Ron Paul's first chief of staff on Capitol Hill, one of Ron Paul's oldest, longest and most trusted advisors. We owe so much to this man. Ladies and gentlemen, please, a warm round of applause for Lou Rockwell.
Thank you. How's the sound? Can everybody hear me? Lean a little bit more into the mic, maybe? Maybe I'll do this. Yeah. Well, it sure is great to be here among all the Paulians. And today I'm going to talk about a subject that, to my knowledge, has never been talked about at any Ron Paul function in all the many years that Ron has been a public figure, and that's Ron Paul. Now, when he asked me what I'm going to talk about today, that's what I told him, and he said, there was this long pause, and then he said, you know, Lou, these events are not to talk about me. And I said, well, Ron, you know, that's what I'm going to talk about. First, I'll mention Ron's family. You know, great people come from great families. And I think sort of as the Paul family at one end of a spectrum, and maybe the Bush family at another end of the spectrum. The first Paul to come to this country from Germany came to escape the draft. He avoided the Prussian draft, the draft of the German Kaiser, in the 19th century, came to this country seeking freedom, established a great family. I had the honor of knowing Ron's parents. Ron's dad ran a dairy in Pennsylvania, and Ron always credited him not only with teaching him about the value of work, the value of integrity, but he was the first one to talk to him about the importance of sound money. And his dad said that inflation, what the Federal Reserve does, is the equivalent of watering the milk. And to a dairyman, that's about the worst thing possible to do. So Ron grew up in Pennsylvania. He was a statewide track champion in a number of events, a tremendous athlete. In fact, I'm told by people in Pennsylvania that who knew him that had he not had knee injuries in college, that he could have gone on to a professional career, or at least a semi-professional career. He was that good at baseball. And I'll skip ahead just a moment. One of the great things when I got a chance to work for Ron was to be at the annual congressional ball game. And you may have seen the picture on Ron's site of him in the Astros uniform. He looks like he's just stepped off the Astros team. And indeed, when he got up to bat, the Democrats in those days had a former professional league, a major league pitcher, pitching to him. And he's very difficult to hit. And he threw it over the plate, and Ron hit a home run out of the park. So. He later said that it was a good thing it was a home run because he had a little bit of trouble getting around the bases, and they might have been able to throw him out if it hadn't been a home run. So he grew up with a great family. He has four brothers, all of whom have turned, are important men, ministers. I don't know if Wayne Paul, his brother Wayne, is here, but he'll be at the barbecue if he's not. But Wayne is a CPA and a heroic champion against in some very tough health circumstances for him, a heroic champion of the rights of private property against the federal prosecutors and the IRS right now, especially in a trial in Las Vegas you may have read about, where a businessman was paying his workers with $50 and $1 gold and silver coins issued by the U.S. Mint. And Wayne explained to the jury that there's nothing in the government laws about these going for fair market value. They are $50 and they're $1. And so none of the workers, of course, earned enough to have to pay taxes according to that rule. And the feds, you might not be surprised, are pretty upset. But Wayne is typical of the Paul family. It's not only Ron. I mean, these boys grew up to be important men in all their fields of endeavor. And it's a tribute. Ron is not only a tribute to himself, and he definitely is that, to his partner, his wife Carol, his girlfriend in high school, and his wife for more than 50 years, but to his parents, and to the great long line of Pauls going back. And then I think of something like the Bush family, George W. Bush, George H.W. Bush, Senator Prescott Bush, going back even further, all of them what Murray Rothbard called the loyal adherents of the Rockefeller World Empire, and people who think nothing of starting wars, looting citizens, doing any kind of crime to enhance their own power and their own financial position, exact opposite of the Paul family. I have a feeling the mic just came on. today is August 15th, and the anniversary of August 15th, 1971, the evil day when Richard Nixon imposed price and wage controls and closed the gold window, that is, cut the final tie between the dollar and gold, leading to a entirely discretionary monetary policy. And as bad as things were before that, if you take a look at a chart from August 15th, 71, So Ron became a physician, as you know. He was always a very successful student, worked his way through high school, always working at his dad's dairy, worked in college. He was a member of a fraternity. He was in charge of all the food service. He had to make sure the food was cooked and bought, and he also worked in the bookstore, 4-0 student, Duke Medical School. And it was at Duke Medical School, wonderfully enough, that he first encountered the Austrian economists. Started reading F.A. Hayek and Ludwig von Mises and Murray Rothbard and Hans Senholtz, Henry Hazlitt, all men he would later meet and become friends with and colleagues of and carry on their tradition. So he got out. He was a very successful doctor. One of his early opponents, Bob Gamage, who lost to him, said, you know, we just didn't take him seriously. I didn't realize that he had delivered half the babies in Brazoria County. He said, literally, because there were only two obstetricians at that time. He said, everywhere I went, people were, you know, had been either delivered by Ron or had their children delivered by Ron. There were no way they were voting for anybody else. So Ron's a successful doctor. I can remember being in the college square at Hillsdale, Michigan, when I heard the Nixon news. It was like a bolt of lightning hit me, and Ron had exactly the same feeling. And with Ron's case, it made him decide he was going to be a public official. He was going to at least try to speak out for these ideas in an election. He was going to run for Congress. And as he often tells the story, Carol said, but, you know, that's a terrible idea. You know, I don't want you going to Washington. He said, I'm not going to win. He said, there's no way anybody's going to elect me with these ideas. But, you know, I'm going to have to explain this statement. He's a natural-born politician. And by that I mean not that he's a liar or a demagogue, and of course we know, right? That's the other sense. But it was nothing for him to wear out 4 and 5 pairs of shoes walking neighborhoods when he was running in those early elections. And he loves meeting people. He loves teaching the ideas of liberty. And he was he was a great candidate. So the first time he ran, he did not win. Then he won in a special election. In 1976, the Democratic, long-term Democrat, he's the first Republican congressman from, at that time, the 22nd District. And he was the first Republican congressman. The long-time Democrat was appointed to a federal job on the Maritime Commission. I guess the bribes must have been more lucrative there than as a congressman. So he was happy to go. So Ron won, and to everybody's huge surprise, and because, as I mentioned about, say, the shoe leather business, he won that election. The Democrats were surprised. The Republicans were surprised. So the Democrats determined they were going to get him the next time. And when the special election, he was only elected in March, he had to run again in November. And the Democrats were determined to get him, and they did get him. And they stole the election exactly like something out of Chicago. I mean, we had people, thousands of alleged people, quote-unquote people, who were not on the rolls but who had voted from gas stations. There was even one person who voted from the Houston Astrodome as their residence. Public libraries, empty lots. So we had evidence of thousands of bad votes. Ron only lost by a couple hundred, and he took this to Congress, and Tip O'Neill, of course, just laughed him out of town. And I remember one of the congressmen who was involved in that, Democratic congressman, later was caught in the Abscam scandal. I don't know if anybody here remembers that, but a bunch of crooked congressmen who were caught. And I always, this guy who was particularly against Ron, I remember he was filmed taking a bribe from what he thought was a Saudi Arabian prince, and he was putting $100,000 in, which is a lot of even $100 bills, into his pockets of his suit and so forth. And he looks at the Saudi Arabian prince and also the camera, and he says, "Does it show?" So it showed. Showed in his eyes and in his face and his soul. So Ron, again, you know, never daunted, decided he ran again. He won. I had the honor of going with him to Washington and working for him. And I could tell many stories, but they discovered that they had an unusual guy to deal with. I remember being there one night when he was in his office. I'm in the outer office, and I get a call. It's the White House calling. It's Ronald Reagan. I didn't talk to Reagan, but I mean, Reagan was calling for Ron. He's calling, now, despite what you might hear about the myths, Ronald Reagan was not calling Ron to, say, congratulate him on opposing spending and taxing. Wasn't calling to get his advice or to enlist his help in those causes. No, he was calling him to vote for spending. In this case, it was one of the B-bombers. I don't remember, B-1, B-2, the Widow Killer, whatever those planes are. One of these weapons that only is used in aggression, only is used to bomb other countries, has nothing to do with defense. There were huge deficits at that time, huge deficits. Reagan's first deficit was $100 million. We would think that was pretty great these days. But, of course, Ron was always a fighter against deficits, and Reagan, as all these things always happen, offer you good things if you go along and bad things if you don't go along. But the president soon discovered that Ron Paul has an untwistable arm. He cannot be moved. There was another time when Newt Gingrich, who was speaker at this time, he's giving instructions to all the Republicans, telling them in the usual fashion, good things are going to happen to you if you vote with us on this horrible spending bill. Bad things will happen to you if you don't. He's instructing them. He's telling them it's a three-line whip. That's an English, comes from English parliamentary practice. It's the most threatening kind of a thing you can get as a member of parliament. They triple underline the fact that you have to vote either yes or no on this bill. So he said, everybody, you know, nobody can dissent on this. Everybody is set to go. And then he says, of course, Ron Paul. I don't mean Ron Paul. So Gingrich was upset, but of course I thought that was a nice tribute. And indeed, he couldn't get Ron Paul. All these wonderful votes of 430-odd to 1 have been a huge teaching process. You know, if it's 398 to 22, nobody pays attention. But if there's one person who's saying no, we all want to know, well, gee, who is that and why did he do it? It's taught even some of the congressmen. One recently, and what happened after his great fundraising success in the presidential election, the congressman would all come up to him and say, you know, how did you do that? What was the firm you hired? What special trick, technological trick did you have? Right, it's inconceivable to them that the people would actually spontaneously rise up and support a man like Ron Paul. So this lady congressman was asking him this question. He was too polite to point to the board where it was one of these votes, you know, 432 to 1. That's the reason. That's the reason that people have supported him. So gradually, of course, he never had power in the House. He could have been, by this time, been a big-time committee chairman. He could have been one of the barons of the Republican Party when they were in power, giving out the contracts, getting who knows what in return, being on Meet the Press, being feted everywhere, being considered a great guy, because he wouldn't do it. He proceeded carefully, quietly, on the same path, never varied, never went through either the ditch on either side, stayed on the path that he started out with, the path of liberty. His concerns about our civil liberties, about our economic liberties, about peace, against war. It was Joe Sobern who said, conservatives dislike big government unless it's killing people. Well, Ron has had a great effect in teaching people about what kind of a government program war is, why it's not a good thing, especially, of course, for the dead. When he first ran, he promised he would term limit himself, I'm sorry to say. But, of course, the man of his word. So he decided, after the three terms that he said he was going to run were up, he was going to quit the House, and that's when Senator John Tower of Texas, was killed in a plane crash. And so Ron decided he was going to run for the Senate. And the White House was very unhappy about that. And Phil Graham, they wanted to be the senator, and they pushed him, and they were very nasty to Ron. There was even a break-in of Ron's office where important papers were stolen. Some famous people in the Republican Party involved in that, guys you sometimes see on television, people who worked for President Bush. And, of course, that's the kind of people they are. Ronald Reagan came out against Ron. The whole Republican establishment went against him. But he campaigned all over Texas, and as he always did, he did not win that election, of course, but patiently, was step by step, educating people. Then he was out of office. He, in part, besides starting up his practice again, went into the coin business, into the precious metals business with the late Bert Blumert. I might say a man who was a Ron Paul in that business. Ron thought it was important for all of us to have some gold and silver to protect ourselves. Then in 1988, he decided to run for the Libertarian presidential nomination, got that. Again, educated a lot of people. Even I think Bill Buckley was educated, much against his will. I remember in one TV appearance, and maybe you've seen the Morton Downey Jr. YouTube where Ron is on. And again, when you see him there, and I can tell you when I first met him in 1975 at a Libertarian conference where he was talking about health care and what was going to be ahead for us as patients in the future if we allowed the government to continue like this, because he was exactly right. And it teaches exactly the same things that he taught then based on Austrian economics, on libertarianism, on his very, very deep reading of economics. He is an economist. I mean, he doesn't have his doctorates in medicine, obviously, rather than economics. But just as he's a great historian, a great foreign policy analyst, he's a wonderful economist. He always built up a large mailing list. In those days, we thought the mailing list was just unbelievably huge and difficult to handle. I think we had 75,000 people in a paper mailing list. That was significant. Of course, now it's 400,000 through the email. In 1994, he saw an opening in the 14th district, this district, and the longtime Democratic congressman was bribed by the Republicans to become a Republican. And so Ron challenged him in the primary, and you had every creep in the Republican Party in the 14th district campaigning against Ron, from Newt Gingrich to George W. Bush to George H.W. Bush to, I guess they would have had Greenspan if they could have brought him in, but they had every creep. Didn't work. Partly because they can't smear him. They ran ads against him that he was against the drug war. That meant he wanted to sell heroin to schoolgirls. Right? You don't have to see Ron Paul on the screen or know anything about him to realize, it's just a lie. So the lies didn't work. And quite wonderful he was elected. Of course, he's been elected since. Again, he's a backbencher. He could be, even under the Democrats, he could be in a very powerful position. But that would necessitate the normal practice of, I'll vote for you, your pork barrel project, you vote for mine. I'll vote for your scam, your unconstitutional bill, you vote, and I'll vote for yours. And, of course, another thing, and when he went up there originally, he ran into other congressmen, many, many other Republican congressmen, who would literally laugh when he would say, my first consideration is this bill constitutional? They just thought it was a joke. I mean, it was like, this is a guy from the 18th century. Well, he's built his army. And, boy, we saw it during the presidential campaign. He taught millions of people, especially young people. And all of us know about his audit the Fed bill, which is going gangbusters in Washington. His great book, I hope his next bestseller, End the Fed, is due out very soon. I'm told have already ordered copies to be shipped to them at the Fed. So, darn right. Darn right. So I have great pleasure in thinking of Bernanke staying up late at night reading this book in horror. Great stuff. So, when we look at what they're doing in Washington, when we look at Obama's health care, although my own guess is it's going down, and much of the Obama prestige with it. Great to be in this mob, by the way. Because, the important thing to remember, and this is when Jesse Benton talked about why it's so important, in addition to political activism for Ron, more important is the educational work. And that's because everything is determined by the climate of ideas. Ideas are more powerful than armies, as Ludwig von Mises said. if we just look at what's happened, for example, with this health care bill, a couple of months ago, they were an arrogant bunch of guys as normal. Sure, they were going to shove this down our throats with no opposition. They had majority in both houses of Congress. Didn't happen. What happened? People changed their minds. I think the American, there's polling to indicate this, the American middle class woke up and said, holy smokes, this is going to make things much tougher for me and for my parents and for my children, and they're going to do that so that in order they can do better for the illegal immigrants and the welfare bums and similar people. This is all, as I hate to quote Joe the Plumber, but he was right. When he predicted the Obama administration would be about redistribution. And, of course, that's fundamentally what it is about. And the medical business is redistributionist. So middle-class Americans woke up, and they don't want it. And, you know, all that is required is a change in the climate of opinion. There was an early libertarian theorist, Murray Rothbard, writes about him, Etienne de Labouetti, in hundreds of years ago in France. David Hume wrote about this, Mises, Rothbard, many, many others. Government depends on the consent of the governed, even a dictatorship. They have to have our tacit consent. Basically, by the way, take a look at BOETIE on LouRockwell.com. You'll find Murray's essay about this and also the De La Buede essay. But everything depends on the consent of the governed because they're parasites. They're a bunch of fleas on the dog of the people, is the way I always think about it. They can be scratched off. Yeah. And there have been instances throughout history when there have been governments that have almost dried up like leaves and blown away because people changed their minds. It happened in 18th century America. It's happened in other countries. It can happen again. And there have been a number of instances recently where popular opinion changed and government was forced to go along. The government seems like an impenetrable fortress, stone walls a mile high, vast troops and secret police and the FBI and the IRS and the EPA and the, you know, the whole CPS and the whole alphabet from hell located in Washington. But they're not. They're actually fundamentally weak. By the way, they're aware of their weakness. They know that this is why the constant search for legitimacy. This is why there are public schools. It's why in the public schools, in the universities, in the media, government itself spends so much time telling you how wonderful they are. They're just wonderful. Now, you people in the private sector, you're a sad bunch. You know, you're interested in your family. You're interested in your future. Thank goodness we have the government, where they're interested only in the common good, the national defense, all the rest of those lies. But, of course, the government is not only not interested in those things. It's interested in its own interest. It's interested in its power, its money, and its glory. Some of them even like killing people, why they go into government. And they are another interest. And being a libertarian, being a Ron Paulian, means that you understand that they're not about the public interest. There's only one Ron Paul. And maybe there's ever only been one Ron Paul in all of American political history, I might say. Seems to me he's a unique figure that in future historians are going to look back on Ron Paul and see one of the important men of the West. Because... you know, when you look on what he's done, you look at the people he's converted, you look at the army he's built, you look at the slow, steady steps that he's taken towards teaching people, he is changing the climate of opinion. This is very threatening to the regime. They don't like it, and they don't like it because it's so effective. I see it especially with the Fed. I've been interested in the Fed ever since I was a teenager. I can tell you, nobody was interested in the Fed. It was like a Migo issue, right? Go to sleep. It was the name maybe on the bill in your pocket. That was about it. I tried to tell people, you're being ripped off. How come that's not interesting? I had no effect. Ron Paul had that effect in teaching about Austrian business cycle theory, and teaching about the nature of the giant counterfeiter we call the Federal Reserve, and talking about the recessions and depressions, the what's happened to the average American standard of living, which has not gone up in so many years. By the way, not in real terms gone up ever since Nixon ended the final tide of gold and these guys got their total discretionary monetary policy. So Ron Paul, step by step, staying on that same path, has awakened an army. And we're seeing it with this Fed bill. More and more Americans are interested in the Fed. There was a great article in Forbes. I say great from maybe a different standpoint than the authors. He said, we need to make the Federal Reserve boring again. He said it's dangerous if people are interested in the Fed. These great minds can't meet by themselves and decide what's best for the country, set interest rates, set the monetary policy. They have to worry about the people. Well, darn right. So I think never again are people going to find the Fed boring. They're understanding its history. I think Ron's book is going to be a major impetus towards this and the Fed. We know the chant. That's why he gave it that name, because he heard that chant on this campaign trail. And I'll end with one of my favorite moments in the campaign. It was a rally at the University of Michigan after the Dearborn debate, where, of course, he was treated badly as he was treated at every debate. Yet, did that stop him? Straight ahead, right go, foot step by step, marching, going. So there were 4,000 kids in the quadrangle at the University of Michigan, a very liberal school. Kids said that they never heard of a congressman or even a presidential candidate getting that many kids out. So Ron is speaking to them. He's speaking to them about the free market, about government spending, about deficits, about taxes. Everybody's applauding, talking about foreign policy, about why wars of aggression in Iraq and other places are so damaging to liberty and morality, and not to speak of the stacked up corpses. And then he started to talk about monetary policy. And spontaneously, kids started chanting, end the Fed, end the Fed. And it was like a, you know, it was like chills up and down your back. And some of them started lighting dollar bills, folded dollar bills. So I always thought of them saying, Mr. Bernanke, this is for you. So Ron was startled, obviously very pleased, but, you know, he should have known. He should have known that all these decades of work, 7 days a week, never stopping, morning, noon, and night, teaching, building on the work of the great Austrian economists, creating an army of millions, an army of peace, an army of education, an army that's changing the climate of opinion in this country. We have very exciting times ahead of us for freedom, and that's all thanks to Dr. Ron Paul. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, I had the opportunity to sit and videotape just a 10-minute chat between Ron and Lou the other day, and it was just amazing. It's just it's a treasure is what it was. We're going to have it up on YouTube, but just the wealth of knowledge and information that Lou and Ron have, it's just really humbling to be around. And I'd like to thank everybody again for coming out, and we apologize that it's so crowded. We have 900 chairs set in here, and we thought that would be enough, but I guess apparently liberty and freedom are just too popular.